Welcome, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you.
Welcome to our May meeting of the Australian Institute of International Affairs, and once again, of course, it's my pleasure to thank the University for allowing us to use their facilities and for helping us too with publicity. The choice of topic this evening was not a terribly difficult one to make. We discovered that we had some local expertise that was too good to overlook. And so we decided that we would have three speakers instead of one, but that we would also invite audience participation, perhaps more vigorously than we usually do, because we know that there are many interested members of the audience who have a stake, really, in the welfare and future of Eastern Europe. And so, of course, we welcome you tonight. I don't think we'll need any bouncers to control the meeting. There were a few ominous signs that I might have misread, and so I'm prepared for anything, but I know that it will be a very peaceful and productive meeting. There aren't very many housekeeping notices to give you tonight, because a couple of important commitments that will fall due later in the year can't be announced as yet, but they will be shortly. However, I do invite those of you who may be willing to consider joining the Institute to consider collecting a form here afterwards, or to contact us at a later date. We do need more members, and our membership dues are the smallest in the country, which doesn't mean we give the least impressive service, but we know that Tasmania is a poor state. And no, there are other reasons too why we want to keep the annual dues fairly modest here. Now, there is one forthcoming event that Richard Eggleston has asked me to announce, and we're happy to do so, because the person who's going to be giving a public lecture here on Thursday the 5th of June is very well known to the Institute, and the topic that he's going to be speaking on is certainly relevant to our Institute. Ross Garnaut, whom many of you will know, will be speaking on Thursday the 5th of June to launch the Institute for the Study of Social Change, which is about to take effect in the School of Social Sciences in the Faculty of Arts. Now, it's a fairly wide, broad, vague label, and I'm not going to try and defend the naming of the Institute for the Study of Social Change. You would need to inquire of the university, I think, because the university, as I understand it, is expected to concentrate its areas of research strength under five headings or so, and the way in which they could group the expertise and interests of the social scientists was under a broad umbrella called the Institute for the Study of Social Change. But leaving that aside, Ross Garnaut's topic will be Australia's economic and social future after the resources boom. And as you will know, Ross had a hand in the development of Australia's engagement with Northeast Asia with the Garnaut Report. I think it was 1989. And, of course, he was ambassador to China. He's also carries a certain burden of shame, perhaps. Not guilt, but he might, or embarrassment, possibly, for the controversy that surrounded his report on the costs of managing climate change. And he may be willing to touch on that subject as well. So that's Thursday the 5th of June. Now, we come to our theme tonight, Ukraine and the Limits of Politics. Our three speakers will have a fair division of labour between them, but there may be some overlap. And I'm grateful to all three. Professor Jan Pakulski, who's of course well known as a very senior professor of sociology and former Dean of Arts here, has published widely, and the subject matter of his books, while not specifically focused on foreign affairs, certainly relate to leadership issues in Eastern Europe. He's Polish-born, educated, has a master's degree from the University of Warsaw, and democratisation and post-communism in Eastern Europe are among his research interests. So he's not going to be the first speaker, he'll be the second one, I'll come to that. Matthew Sussex is head of the politics and international relations here at the university and a former president of AIIA. And his research interests are focused on international security, Russian politics, and foreign policy and strategic theory. And he edited the volume Conflict in the Former USSR, which was published by the University of Cambridge Press. Matt Killingsworth, and who prefers to be called Matt, by the way, and there was a mistake here in actually spelling out Matthew. It's a very sensitive issue. One of them likes Matt and the other one likes Matthew, and that's one way of distinguishing between the two, because Matt Killingsworth is is a lecturer in international relations at the University of Tasmania and currently researching issues pertaining to the laws of war and international criminal justice, with a special interest in the emerging responsibility to protect doctrine. Now, with regard to the division of labour or the presentation sequence, I thought that Matt Sussex should go first and focus on the political developments in Russia and foreign policy objectives and ambitions of Russia as he sees them. And incidentally, he does visit, he goes into the field from time to time, so it's not all abstract and a perspective from a great distance. And then I thought if Jan could follow with some speculation, if he doesn't wish to be too dogmatic, about the possible implications for Poland, the Baltic Republics and Eastern Europe generally of the current crisis in Ukraine. And then finally, Matt Killingsworth could traverse the wider implications for European security and the international order of the current crisis in the Ukraine. But if there is some overlap, that's fine. There won't be too much of it, and it'd be good to make a few points more emphatically if more than one person makes it. And then at the end, and this should only be a 10 to 12 minute presentation by each of them, we'll have plenty of time then for interaction with the audience. And I invite you to postpone questions or any shouts of protest until all three have spoken, so that we can have the discussion programme right at the end, and there will be a smooth flow from one speaker to the other. So it's my great pleasure now to introduce Matt Sussex.
Thanks, Peter, and thanks very much, folks, for coming out tonight. This is a topic that is both close to my heart and close to my keyboard. In fact, I've been frantically bashing things out on Russia and Ukraine. I always like, in settings like this, going first. Going first is awesome because you're safe in the knowledge that you can be completely outrageous in what you say, and by the time you've got to the end, and we've gone through three speakers, no one will remember what I've had to say. So I'm going to take that on, or at least that challenge on, of being a little bit outrageous. And I'm going to start off by telling you two fairy stories. Here's fairy story number one. The peace-loving people of Ukraine, especially those in the West, watch in dismay as a shadowy and corrupt government hijacks their freedom. They rise up peacefully in protest. In Russia, Vladimir Putin, the evil puppet master, smiles knowingly as his puppet Ukrainian government opens fire on peaceful protesters. But people power, in the end, wins out. The ruling clique is forced to flee, and there are only a handful of sympathisers in the east of the country, and democracy triumphs. Fairy story number one. Fairy story number two. The peace-loving people of Ukraine, similar theme, especially those in the east, watch in dismay as ordinary people in Kiev are whipped into a nationalistic frenzy by the far right. These nationalists organise snipers to fire on both police and unarmed demonstrators. They topple the democratically elected government in Kiev. In the east, people have no option but to organise militias to prevent the fascists from taking over their homes, and they hold free and peaceful elections to secede, and democracy triumphs. Both of those, I think you'll agree with me, have elements of truth in them. However, They are both fundamentally fanciful, and I think you would have to have a vested interest or, unfortunately, be hopelessly naive to believe either of them is true. In fact, I think there's a very simple reason for the crisis in Ukraine, and particularly involving Russia, and that is power, or, more particularly, money, territory and energy as components of power. I think what's going on in Ukraine at the moment has absolutely nothing to do with who's right and who's wrong, and nothing to do with democracy, liberty, freedom, what's just, what's not just, who's got the responsibility to protect. And it's got everything to do with the geopolitical situation that was left by the collapse of the USSR in 1991 as the structural cause. It's got everything to do with the wrangling between the West and Russia over what that post-Soviet space should look like. And ultimately, I think it's got everything to do with a collective failure to manage the situation. And I would say the EU, the US, Russia, and even Ukrainians themselves are culpable in that collective failure. How then can we understand this situation in a way that goes beyond the simple division, as we tend to see in the media, between goodies and baddies? And you'll get it both from Russian state TV and you'll get it from Western TV as well. I think it's instructive to have a look at who wants what in this conflict and crisis. Now, Ukrainians, and it depends obviously which Ukrainians you ask, but let's say at the moment Ukrainians are of the pro-Western kind, the ones in power currently in Kiev, they want something that they haven't had for a long time, and that is full sovereignty without external meddling. They want the good life, basically. They want the common European home that Mikhail Gorbachev, when they were in the USSR, said that they could have. They want EU membership, and they potentially want NATO membership. And their main fear is that Russia wants them to be fundamentally marginalised. And they're right, because Russia does want them marginalised. Russia wants Ukraine to be weak and firmly within what it sees as its geopolitical sphere of influence. It wants that because it has fears of its own. Russia's fears are fundamentally about NATO, a club for Westerners and Western audiences that has said on numerous occasions they will never be part of or will not be part of, creeping ever closer to its borders. And it's said this for years and years and years. It's only really been recently, however, that it's been able to do anything about it, mainly since turning itself into a sort of petro-state, if you like. Within this crisis, the United States wants the EU to handle it. The United States is not very interested in Eastern and Central Europe, and has not been for quite a while in a strategic sense, because it's focused on its rebalance, or its pivot, or tilt, if you like, to the Asia-Pacific. And it can't afford to look at two strategic theatres at once. It certainly, and was very quick to say this, is not at all prepared to fight for Ukraine with NATO or otherwise. The EU, for its part, simply wants the problem to go away. And it really doesn't know how it can resolve the Russia-Ukraine issue. And that's one of the reasons why the sanctions that were announced on largely Russian politicians have been so gobsmackingly weak. The EU itself is very split on what to do. But there are some other reasons as well. The EU wants the problem to go away because it wants to preserve trade with Russia. EU-Russia trade is edging up towards $1 trillion US dollars per annum. That's a lot of money. To put that into perspective, it's about three-quarters of Australia's GDP in trade between Russia and the European Union per annum. And remembering, of course, that Australia is the 12th biggest economy in the world. For those of you who prefer a more local perspective, you could take Tasmania's gross state product, and, well, you could probably put it into a parking meter, quite honestly, but get some change back. Apologies. You would have to multiply it 42 times Tasmania's gross state product to get the level of trade between Russia and the EU annually. Now, of course, in the EU, there are many nations, Germany chief amongst them, dependent on Russian gas. And their desire to continue trading with Russia is also predicated on a fear that Russia will turn off that tap. On the Ukrainian side, or in terms of its relations with Ukraine, the EU doesn't want to pay to keep Ukraine afloat. It's suffered, of course, Ukraine, from the same rampant corruption and very bad governance that Russia itself experienced during the 1990s after the collapse of communism. And by any measure, Ukraine is in very poor shape. It needs an immediate injection of between 15 to 20 billion US dollars merely to avoid defaulting on its loans. Its GDP per capita is 7,200 US dollars a year, which is half Russia. It ranks at 112th in the world, which is worse than Albania and worse than Namibia. And the same story is true when you look at other indicators. Life expectancy, for instance, in the OECD, average life expectancy combined, males and females, is around 80 years. In Ukraine, it's 67.5, and that ranks it 131st in the world, which is about the same as Bangladesh and about the same as Iraq, and in fact worse than North Korea. I hope you're taking notes, by the way, because there'll be a test later on this. Let me shift to some likely outcomes. What do I think is going to happen? I think Putin has been very much emboldened by what he sees as Western weakness and Western division over Ukraine. And this is where I'll be quite controversial and say, I think there will be war. I think it won't be a big war. I think it'll be a limited war. I think NATO will send some arms to the Ukrainians to save face. But I think Ukraine will lose. And the industrialised east of Ukraine, the Donbass region, will become a Russian satrapy. It more or less is anyway. You'll have a pro-Western rump, Ukraine, and that'll inherit a lot of Ukraine's debt, if not all of it. It will turn westward with an overall preference for a stronger NATO presence in Eastern and Central Europe. And you'll basically have now a formal demarcation of the dividing line between the West and Russia that was very much unclear, or has been very unclear, since 1991. Are there any lessons from this? I think there are lots of lessons from the crisis in Ukraine, regardless of whether I'm right or wrong on my predictions. I think the crisis in Ukraine tells us a lot about the limits of so-called soft power Europe. Europe does love to tell everybody that it has no military might and doesn't seek any, and it seeks only to persuade others, to engage them in dialogue. This is effectively talking softly and carrying no stick at all. I think the way the EU went about the crisis with, in terms of Russia and Ukraine, was a very, very poor performance. Effectively, it tried to make Ukraine choose, and Yanukovych choose, between Putin's so-called Eurasian Union and an association agreement with the EU. They basically said you can't do both. In order to get the EU's $13 billion in aid, Yanukovych would have had to sign up to about $20 billion extra merely to get close to the association agreement's obligations. I think the crisis in Ukraine tells us also about the limits of collective security, and by that I mean NATO. NATO is not really a collective security organisation because it keeps acting outside where its members are. So in reality, it's more of a collective defence organisation. But because NATO said very, very quickly, we will not fight for Ukraine at all, we will not get engaged militarily, it'll make Poland and Hungary, and Jan will probably have more to say about this later on, much more fearful. I think that it also tells us something about the limits of norms, particularly norms pertaining to the responsibility to protect. Like the word democracy and like the word freedom, I think the R2P is starting to become dangerously like a slogan, and a slogan that can be used for any instrumental purpose, because it is used by both West and East very, very hypocritically. And finally, I'd say what we've witnessed in Ukraine and Russia is the return of realpolitik, not that it ever went away. Putin, I think, has run rings around the West in terms of his acting in a way that the West simply doesn't understand or thinks is reflective of 19th century geopolitics. But it is working. He certainly had no problems with Crimea, and he may well be so emboldened that he has no problems with eastern Ukraine, the Donbass region, either. Personally, I don't think things will end well for Putin, but on this issue, at least, he seems to have all the cards. If the West was serious, I think, it needs a lot more pragmatism when it comes to dealing with Russia and a lot more pragmatism when it comes to dealing with Putin. In the past, it has spoken very strongly about the importance of trade and the importance of laws and norms. I think it should probably stray away from those, stop telling fairy stories, and start being a little bit more practical in the way it engages with Russia. Thank you, folks.
Thank you.
Professor Pekulski to follow up.
Hello, and apologies to those Ukrainians who hate to speak to hear non-Ukrainians speaking about Ukraine. I'm an imposter in that respect, but from the part of Europe which looks at Ukraine with a high degree of sympathy and hope. Instead of talking about Ukrainian-European relations in any systematic way, let me focus on three major misconceptions which prevail in the coverage of the crisis in Ukraine and indeed in the European Union and Russia. First misconception is that Ukraine is Little Russia. This is the phrase used by Putin. It's not, it has never been, and it's unlikely to be. They are very different. Secondly, a misconception that Ukrainians and Russians are brothers. Well, perhaps in the sense of Karamazov, brothers, like from Dostoevsky. But the relations between Ukrainians and Russians, especially in the 20th century, has been very tense and checkered. And without understanding the basis of it, you won't understand the current political configurations, especially of public opinion in Ukraine and Russia. And the third misconception, which was already partly mentioned by Matt, is that we are dealing with some sort of resurgence of right-wing fascism or extreme nationalism in Ukraine. Far from truth. So perhaps there are quite obvious misconceptions. Nevertheless, it's worth spending 3 minutes on each of them. First, Moscow and Kiev are two competing centers of historical civilizational developments, very, very different. Moscow, which used to be referred to up until the 19th century as Muscovy, derives from a political entity which formed around the 9th, 10th century, but which was formed, especially in terms of political culture and political arrangements, by the Mongol yolk, the Mongol domination, which lasted until 1480. By contrast, Kiev was a center of historical and civilizational development, which took quite a different tradition. It wasn't dominated. Of course, in 1250s, it was destroyed by the Mongol invasion, but it was never for any prolonged period of time under the Mongol influence, and it did not adopt the autocratic tradition which led the Muscovy to become Russian Empire and then the Soviet Union. There is some sort of historical connection between those three, especially Soviet Union under Stalinist regime. So they are quite different. The Muscovy did not have Renaissance, nor was affected by Reformation, typical paths to modernity of Western Europe. Kiev was participating in both, and it shaped a very different political tradition. Russian and Ukrainian languages are similar. They are both Indo-European languages. But they are as different, if you prefer, as Dutch is from German. Russian speakers and Ukrainian speakers would understand each other in a similar way as Dutch speaker or Deutsch speakers and German speakers would understand each other. But also Ukrainians would easily understand Poles and Slovaks. So there are very strong Western influences. I won't go through historical traditions, but enough to say that Kiev and so-called Kievian Rus, the very important political entity, extremely important both in 10th, 11th century, it was the major entity, European entity, and Muscovy, well, shaped quite differently, and Kievian Rus was for nearly 4th century under a strong influence and domination of the Lithuanian-Polish Commonwealth. Why Muscovy evolved into very highly autocratic empire, Russian empire. Keep in mind that these two are very different and their development was quite different. But that leads me to the second misconception. National identity, national literature, national poetry, and national language in Ukraine developed during the Romantic period of the 19th century, under the strong influence of West European Romanticism, highly liberal nationalism of people like Byron, who thought that all peoples deserve to have the independent political entity. But the difference from Russians and Russian culture was shaped by most dramatic events of the 20th century. Ukraine, after a very complicated struggles when Kiev was occupied 12 times between the end of the Russian Revolution and 1922, when the Soviet Union was created by different forces, but in 1922, the political entity that emerged was Ukrainian Soviet Socialist Republic. That was the result of this kerfuffle's political development. It was under strong Bolshevik influence, while the western part of Ukraine, which remained throughout the 19th century under the strong Habsburg Austro-Hungarian influence, developed its own specific identity. And because Austro-Hungarians were much more tolerant than Russians or Prussians, who always claimed pieces of land which today forms Ukraine, it was the seat of the national identity and national language. It was mostly spoken, Ukrainian was mostly spoken in the Galician, Volhynian part of Ukraine. The drama of the 20th century can be summarized in three points. First and major problem or major blow to Ukrainian-Russian friendship and brotherhood was the Ukrainian dekulakization, as it was called, Stalinist policy of the 1930-32 of collectivization, which was in Ukrainian land conducted in a most brutal manner. It was followed by the Great Famine, which took between 3 and 8 million Ukrainian, and which was politically brought famine. Simply these areas of Ukraine which Stalin decided to take revenge on, were surrounded by troops, and transport of food was cut, and people were starving to death for 2.5 years. And the third blow was the Great Terror, in which the major target were not only Russian upper echelons of Russian army and police, but Ukrainian nationalists too. They were the second major victim of the Great Terror, which was continued through the war. Very few people know that between 1930 and 1945, on the territory of Ukraine, more people died than in any other human conflict known. During the Second World War, about 27 citizens of the then Soviet Union were killed. The majority of those people were civil victims, and 8 million of the civilian victims were Ukrainians. Ukrainians were more frequently, in absolute terms, killed during this dramatic times of between 39 and 45 than Russians. Although more Russians died in the military casualties, more Ukrainians died as a total casualties of the warfare on the bloodlands of Ukraine and Eastern Europe. So remember about it. The reason for this disproportionate victimization of Ukrainians were that some of them sided with the Germans, and they were victims of most brutal German suppression of Ukrainian nationalism. They were also among the perpetrators, because they formed also the Waffen-SS divisions, Galicia. But most of them died also, much more died fighting against the Nazis. And those victims felt very bitter after the war, when the Russians, so to speak, appropriated the tradition of victimhood in the war. To summarize, the nation which suffered proportionately most during the Second World War were Belarusia, and in absolute numbers, Ukrainians. And Russians were after Ukrainians. The Russians very frequently treat the Red Army as a Russian army, forgetting that between 4.5 and 7 million of soldiers in the Red Army were Ukrainians. And finally, fascism. It's a label which is attached to the right wing in Ukraine, and indeed, in the post-1991 independence period, right-wing nationalist form, especially Svoboda Party, which is rather ugly, and there is also the right bloc in Ukraine, but they enjoy support of between 2% and 3% of the population, as research shows. They are disproportionately represented in the Ukrainian government. That's true, because it was the policy of Yanukovych, to bring nationalists to Ukrainian government. So there are 3 ministers and 1 deputy out of 21 which represent those right wing. But calling them fascists would be a gross exaggeration. And part of the attempts to torpedo the forthcoming election in Ukraine is, especially by Russians, is that they would show how dramatically small support for extreme right is in Ukraine. The dominant force is Batyushchina, the party of national country. So the relations between Ukraine, Russia, and Europe is complicated and has to be seen without the distortion of massive propagandas, misconceptions. And it's related, as Matt mentioned, and I think Matt will also mention, but the current global configuration, whereby Putin, from about 2003-04, after the Orange Revolution in Ukraine, which worried him very much, decided to form a project which is alternative to European Union. It's called Eurasian Project. And Ukraine plays a central role in Putin's plan, especially for the so-called tariff agreement, which tries to link the countries of the Eurasian zone, Eurasian Union, into a form of quasi-Comecon, economic agreement, whereby the substandard goods are exchanged for submarket prices, like in old Comecon. And that would be terrible. That would be, if this arrangement came to fruition, and if Ukraine was locked in this tariff union, it would determine the economic future of Ukraine and probably political future too. Therefore, Ukrainians responded so strongly to the refusal of Yanukovych to sign the Easter Partnership Agreement, and the Euromaidan, the demonstration started from the moment when Yanukovych turned, after talks in Moscow, back and decided to join the Eurasian group rather than European Union. Thank you very much.
Thank you, John. In introducing or reintroducing Matt Killingworth, I have to apologise for not emphasising that he was the author of a very fine book, Civil Society in Eastern Europe, a communist Eastern Europe, so that adds to his credentials. Thank you.
A footnote on credentials.
Thank you, Peter, for the very generous invitation to speak tonight, and thank you, Jan and Matt, for speaking before. You've made my job fairly difficult. I was somewhat concerned that I was sort of going back and going to speak about 100 years of history before Jan went back into the 9th century, which somewhat eased my concerns about the historical aspect of my paper. What I want to do is address the broader international ramifications of what we've been witnessing in Ukraine since November. And I think, and I agree with Jan as well, that I think there's a much longer historical aspect to what we're witnessing in Ukraine. I don't think that should ever be forgotten in a variety of aspects. And I'm hoping that perhaps we can have some questions on that later on this evening. So I'm going back a fair way, and in fact, I want to go back 100 years, and I want to speak more broadly about the evolution of international order, and what current events tell us about the limit of politics. And I'm going to start at World War I, which is somewhat appropriate. We're celebrating or commemorating the 100th anniversary of the beginning of World War I this year. And World War I, when it comes about as a collective or a shock to the collective conscious, especially in Europe. This is a period that it's at the back end of the Belle Epoque. Europeans feel that they have conquered science, they've conquered the known world through colonialism, and indeed they feel that they have unlocked the secrets to peace, primarily through collective concerts that have existed since the middle of the 19th century. So in this respect, the catastrophe of World War I comes as a great shock to Europeans. But I think there's also another important caveat for 1914, that there was a general appetite for war in 1914 as well. At least there wasn't an anti-appetite for war. But the end of World War I doesn't change the prevailing world order all that much. In fact, it takes a Great Depression and it takes a Second World War until we have a massive change in order in the international system. And it's the post-1945 environment, which is dominated by ideas of never again, the insurance of how do we not replicate the financial and human catastrophes that characterised the first half of the 20th century. And it's in this post-war era that we find a radical change to ideas of international order. Post-World War II, we have an order that's underpinned by ideas, as I've suggested, of never again, institutionalised through the advent of the United Nations and the Bretton Woods institutions. But post-1945, there's also, to some degree, an accidental order as well. And this accidental order that comes about through or an accidental order that's underpinned by bipolarity and the idea of mutually assured destruction. An order that lasts, vaguely speaking, broadly speaking, for between 1945 to 1991 and the collapse of the Soviet Union. Now, the end of the Cold War ushers in a so-called New World Order. Matt's already alluded to the idea of Gorbachev referring to a common European home. In 1991, Gorbachev also referred to this idea of the emergence of a New World Order, as did George Bush the senior at the time. And this New World Order was going to be an order where liberal democracies would spread, that peace would be ensured through the spread of democracies, Francis Fukuyama's end of history thesis. Institutions, especially the UN, would be reinvigorated, free from the shackles of great power politics. And the idea of what was supposed to eventuate post-1945 would indeed eventuate. However, this period's characterised, instead of the spread of liberal democracies, it's characterised instead by the 1994 Rwandan genocide, various uprisings and humanitarian catastrophes in Somalia, Haiti, the bloody and violent breakup of Yugoslavia, and then following that, a sort of tacit order that's premised in a post-9/11 world on the idea of hunting down Muslim extremists. And so we have a sort of a long history of a variety of orders, premised first on cooperation between great powers, then an idea of sort of institutional cooperation through those post-1945 institutions, the Bretton Woods financial institutions, the United Nations institutions. And then in the post-1991 environment, an amalgam of orders, for want of a better term, that we see a variety of flux of the breakdown of great powers, a degree, or to a degree, a rise of norms in international law, but to a degree a retreat of those as well. So the one I want to investigate, and I guess it's a conclusion to what Jan and Matt have offered, and I'm wary of the time as well, is what next? What type of order are we looking at in our Ukrainian environment? Or what type of the crisis, what does it tell us, in fact, about the limits of politics? The Security Council has compromised. The attempt to institutionalise concerts of great powers, the idea might have been good, but it failed to understand that great powers can also be belligerent. As we know, Russia is a permanent member of the United Nations Security Council, has veto power. So the idea here of the United Nations as a central aspect of peace is immediately compromised. Both Matt and Jan have already alluded to the EU and the degree to which it's compromised. And I think Matt's right on the idea of the limits of soft power in this respect. That the EU, ideologically opposed to the idea of traditional hard power, but it's also somewhat inevitably has divisions within its own members as well. And for those that follow the EU, most of us could see this coming, unfortunate as it is. The US, the upholder of international order since 1945, appears neutered. International pressures, but also the realisation of a declining influence. But what about international law? Russia has clearly violated bilateral agreements with Ukraine, the 1994 arrangement that's required it to protect Ukrainian integrity. But as that's also alluded to tonight, has also cynically used the language of international law and norms, especially the R2P norm, to justify the annexation of Crimea. And indeed, with echoes of the language used in Georgia in 2008. But simultaneously, they've argued that the West's criticism is hypocritical when one considers the illegality, in fact, the illegitimacy of interventions in Kosovo in 1999 and Iraq in 2003. So in continuing the somewhat pessimistic outlook that both Jan and Matt have offered, I'd love to offer something optimistic, I really would, but I'd feel deeply compromised if I did. The somewhat pessimistic and admittedly ambiguous conclusion that I'm offering is that what we might be witnessing is the beginning of a new, somewhat unpalatable order, where great powers are in flux. The up to now lineal progression of norms and laws that serve to limit belligerence retreat from the cosmopolitan back to the state. I'm not a soothsayer, and I can't predict the future, and hence I have limited capacity to do this. But I can confidently say the current crisis has revealed the limits of politics, and especially the degree to which we've understood it up to now. Thank you.
Well, the constant theme is gloom. And there may be some more cheerful messages from the floor, but in any event, I now open up the meeting for questions and answers. And I meant to press something there, thank you. Could you please use the microphone when you're speaking? Thank you, and the microphone will come to you. Thank you very much.
I doubt that I need it, really.
No, you don't need it. It's splendid.
Go away.
Speak up.
I think my words are worth recording. Go back to Matthew Sussex. I think I got the first name of his full glory. I can't remember much of what you said, of course.
Was it?
I do remember the last bit. And in the sort of gloom that was mentioned, you said, the West has to get more pragmatic. This is a touch gestural. Would you care to flesh that out a bit?
Yeah, certainly. It's also based on 2020 hindsight, which is wonderful for everybody to have. But nonetheless, it sort of asks the question, what should the West have done? I think what the West should have done for starters, the moment Crimea was always going to go, actually. It was always a bit of a fait accompli. There's only really one road in and out, and the Russians can seal that off fairly easily. But after Crimea, the West probably should have said, okay, we will immediately give the government in Kiev military assistance. We will give them economic assistance. We will forgive debt. And if there are any further problems to the east, we'll consider revising our strategy. When it comes to Putin, I say that the West should be more pragmatic. Now, policymakers in the West view him completely pragmatically and have done for many, many years. It's just, I think, that the way they go about it is appealing to the wrong type of audience. They tend to use the normative appeal, the democratic appeal, and say, oh, well, we're doing the right thing here. Putin doesn't really respect that very much. And Putin, when he is faced with those types of arguments, is very, very keen to do things like turn off gas taps. Now, that makes the Germans very anxious because, of course, a third of their gas comes from Gazprom. Some slightly tougher language, perhaps some language of the 19th century rather than the 21st century, I think may have given Putin some pause. Hope that answers your question.
Thank you. Yep.
My name is Jako and I'm from Tatarstan. Hands up if anybody does know where Tatarstan. So everyone knows where Tatarstan, right? Mr. Pakulski, to be fair with you, your words were absurd because Putin never calls Ukraine a smaller Russia because he, you know, the story of Ukraine is a bit different because there wasn't Moscow at that time, there wasn't St. Petersburg, the main city of that big country called Kievskaya Rus in Russian, which means Kievan Rus, but the capital of this country was Kiev. And the southern part of Ukraine, which is Crimea, Donbass, Odessa, these parts were called Malorossia, which means small Russia, but it has nothing to do with understanding like small Russia. For example, Tasmania, the name is Tasmania, New Zealand is New Zealand, it's just a name. And The Ukraine itself as a country was created by Russia. There wasn't country Ukraine. Ukraine, we call it Ukraina, which means the verge. The verge means the verge of the big country. So that was the close part to the Europe which belonged to Russia. If you look at the history of Ukraine, it was created by... The territory of Ukraine is created by gifts. Gifts of Stalin, gifts of Khrushchev, gifts of Lenin. There wasn't a country called Ukraine at all until 1990. So when there was a Soviet Union, people would never predict the Soviet Union would collapse eventually, right? So, but it happened, it collapsed, and a lot of territories, a lot of citizens of Soviet Union just stayed, well, became like a citizens of another countries in 1990. So that was like a big mistake, and now Russia, which the main country in Soviet Union, fixes these mistakes, because the Crimea, if you go to Crimea, if you look all monuments in Crimea, it says the word Russia in Crimea. The Russia, the Sevastopol, which is the capital, which is the biggest city in Crimea, was created by Russians, by Catherine the Great. Odessa is a Russian city. Donbass is a Russian places. Donetsk, Kharkov, Russian cities, forever there were Russians.
Okay.
I just want to say that the words that Mr. Pakulski said is just sorry, I don't want to insult Mr. Pakulski, but I just want to say that for me, you're like a simple anti-Russian Polish lecturer. Sorry.
If I could just interpolate there, your reference to Ukraine not being a country. Of course, it was a pretending country. You remember that it was a foundation member of the United Nations because that was the only condition under which Russia, the Soviet Union, would allow India to become a member. So there was a trade-off with the Ukraine and Belarus becoming members, and of course they were controlled by the Soviet Union. Anyone want to comment on that?
Just question. When Ukraine became the UN member?
In 22.
1922.
No, after the UN in 1945.
After the UN.
No, Soviet Union was.
No. Ukraine.
It's a founding member of the.
It was a founding member of the UN simply under the terms of an agreement to allow India, because India wasn't yet fully independent.
That's right. And may I also say about the Jan Pakulski was talking about the Second World War and was always emphasizing on Ukrainian victims. That there was a war. I mean, it had nothing to do exactly with Ukrainians, because when is the war? You prefer that Germans should have taken the whole Soviet Union and Germans should have won the war? I mean, what would have been? What kind of world would have been that? I mean, we were not realizing the main purpose, the main aim during the war for Russians was not to lose the war. And at that time, nobody was distinguishing, especially Stalin, was not distinguishing between the nations, between Ukrainians, Kazakhs. Everyone was fighting. Everyone was dying. It has nothing to do particularly with Ukrainians. There was a war.
Okay. Can I have the microphone, please?
Yes,
thank you.
Lady here.
I'd like the questioner to please explain which version of history you are referring to, because it's not the one that's readily accessible and known to the wider world. Are you being paid to come here, or what is your premise for your words?
I think we might just have one more quick reply and then we'll move on to the next question.
That's the history that I learned in Russia.
That says everything. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Okay. Anyone else? Yes, at the back there. Yeah.
Change of direction completely. We haven't heard much about China's response to all of this. I'd be interested to know what their feelings are on the events in Ukraine, please.
Okay. Anyone be game to answer that?
That's a really good question, actually. The Chinese are quite torn on this, because on the one hand, they have a sort of alliance of convenience. They don't really like the Russians very much, and the Russians don't really like the Chinese very much. But the enemy of the enemy is my friend. They're sort of united within the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. So China has a kind of obligation to put the Russian case that Russia is in fact not engaging in being a revisionist state at all. At the same time, it's very worried because what's going on in Ukraine, of course, is one of the things it fears very much on its own territory, which is splitism, terrorism to an extent. If terrorism is the killing of innocent civilians sort of for political ends. So it sees the breakup of any state as fundamentally problematic, and it's committed itself very much in its own approach to international relations to respect state sovereignty. So it does have quite a few problems with what is going on. Let's face it, in terms of, I suppose, bringing in the previous questioner a bit as well, there is no doubt whatsoever that the friendly green men, as they are portrayed on Russia Today, who patrol around parts of eastern Ukraine, are Russian. They are Russian-trained and they are Russian-armed, and most of them are former Russian servicemen because they will retire to Odessa in the Crimea. Of course they're Russians. That said, there are always two versions of history. There is a very powerful version of history that Russians will believe, and there are, I suppose, some grains of truth in it as well, just as there are grains of truth in the Western version. Personally, I'd say it doesn't really matter whether Ukraine was never or should never be or wasn't a state. It is now, and what happens is going to be quite crucial to whether or not it survives as a state. I hope that sort of takes in those two questions.
Professor Gilbert, Harry.
Thank you very much. Can I start, please, by congratulating all three speakers on what I think is a really splendid performance. I think they did extremely well, if I may say so. I have three footnotes to offer. The first one is on the matter of China. Quite clearly, the Chinese have been impressed by Putin's tactics and the matter in which he has reasserted Russian strength and Russian influence, and by the way that he has used for political purposes his dominance of the oil supply to the whole of Western and Central Europe. The latest news, in case people here don't yet know, is that apparently the Russians and the Chinese are on the verge of an agreement under which the Chinese will be permitted access to Siberian gas at prices only two-thirds of what the Chinese are now paying Australia for liquefied natural gas from us. I hesitate to pronounce as to what Ross Garner would say about the economic consequences of that, but I think it may well turn up. The other two footnotes are less important, but I think it's worth pointing out in talking about the cultural differences, as Jan did, within Ukraine, that in fact the the cultural direction in which Ukraine moved, the Western Ukraine moved, in music and poetry and painting and opera, was Vienna. It wasn't Kiev, and it was certainly not Moscow. Now, that's all a long time ago, but it's perhaps worth stressing the differences between West and East, which you have already come to. My final footnote is actually a note, if I may, of disagreement with Matt Killingsworth. He seemed to say, if I understood him rightly, that the First World War did not lead to any substantial moves of territory and politics. And yet the First World War surely led, if to nothing else, the disappearance of at least three empires, the Russian, the Ottoman, and the Austro-Hungarian. And if you look at the troubles that Europe has had in very recent times, ranging from the Middle East to the Balkans and other places, that surely can be traced in part to the disappearance of the empires that held them in check until 1918.
That's just as a footnote to your footnotes. You will have no doubt read Bob Carr's review of the new biography of Woodrow Wilson, in which he claims that he's by far the worst president the United States has ever had, because it was because of his idealism at Versailles that these three empires disappeared from the map, and that all sorts of subsequent crises would not have occurred if they had survived.
I have also some footnotes. First, for Dr. Sussex, well, your introduction was really great. I agree with most of what you've said. However, you didn't mention one very important reason. I wouldn't say Ukraine wasn't meant to be a country. It wasn't meant to be a nation. So let's stress on this point. It was always divided between East and West. And that's one of the major causes of why this is happening today. The second reason is, since its independence, the Ukrainians haven't decided which republic they want. They want a presidential republic, like in the United States, or a parliamentary one, like in other countries. So that led to a crisis in politics. And many questions, like regarding the constitutions, were not solved because of that, because they couldn't decide whether it should be solved by the president or by the parliament. So that's the first thing. The second thing regarding the European Union, one major thing that not everybody knows, the European Union doesn't want Ukraine, let's face it. They announced it very clearly. They said Ukraine will never see the membership of the European Union, even in the term of our grandchildren. It was very clear. The European Union has its own problems, and they definitely don't want any additional problems like Ukraine. We're talking about 46 million people here. The third thing regarding the European position of the crisis, well, unfortunately, I would say that Europe has lost all its independence or all its credibility in the international arena since 2003. Let's face it, there's no independent European position. It's basically run by the United States. Regarding how the West should deal with the president, I would say the West loved dealing with Yeltsin, who was all the time drunk. It was easy to deal with him. It was easy to take Russian petrol or Russian oil for almost free, Russian resources for free. And obviously when someone like powerful like Putin came to power, they didn't like it much. And they still don't know how to deal with it. I agree with that. Regarding what Mr. Pakulski said, well, I would disagree on the point of the neo-Nazi. I would ask you, have you heard of what they've done? Have you heard about the problems that Eastern Ukrainians are facing, including myself? I was forced to study Ukrainian language to do my master's degree. And that was at Yushchenko's time, who was, you know, not completely neo-Nazi. And I have four questions for you. The first one is, what do people speak in Kiev? Is it Russian or Ukrainian? The second question is anyone on this earth is able to distinguish between an Eastern Ukrainian and a Russian? The third question is, would anyone ever dare to go to a shop in Lvov, which is in the western part of Ukraine, and order something using the Russian language? And the fourth question, the most important one, I think, from which we can draw many conclusions regarding the history of Ukraine and Russia, is when the first Russian-Ukrainian dictionary appeared. Thank you.
Yep. Professor Pokolsky will attempt to answer those. If he can remember them in sequence, I can't.
Roughly. In 1990 and 91, when declaration of state sovereignty occurred in Ukraine, followed by the Act of Independence and by the referendum, over 90% of Ukrainians, majority of those who spoke Ukrainians and majority of those who spoke Russian, declared support for independent Ukraine. Okay? And that tells you something about a specific multi-ethnic character of Ukraine that emerged in 1990-91. It was multi-ethnic and tolerant of ethnic differences and religious differences. There was only one attempt, unsuccessful, in 2014 to make Ukrainian obligatory language, and it was blocked by the president. So Ukrainian was never the sole language. Ukraine has all the time recognized multilingual nature of its nation. It was multilingual and multi-ethnic in a similar way as Switzerland or Canada are multilingual and multi-ethnic. The education, especially higher education, in Ukraine after 90 was open to Russian speakers and Ukrainian speakers. The only period where Ukrainians could not get tertiary education in Ukrainian was under Stalinist rule in the 1930s, when Stalin declared the war against nationalism, which was the war against ethnic identity of Ukrainians. There is no evidence of fascism in Ukraine. It depends what you mean by fascism. But if you mean extreme right-wing nationalism, it probably has more stronger support among the National Front in France or the Golden Dawn in Greece or the Freedom Party in the Netherlands than in Ukraine. We know that because there have been surveys of public opinion and political views. And as I mentioned in my brief presentation, between 2-3% of voters supported extreme nationalists in Ukraine. And their presence in government, which has been so widely trumpeted by the Russian propaganda, by the Putin's propaganda, does not reflect popular support. There was also a survey, a series of surveys, about the overall orientation of Ukrainians, whether they are pro-Eurasian or pro-European Union. And the survey conducted in 2012 shows that over 70% of Ukrainians declared support for pro-European Union orientation. So there is no doubt. The facts are supported by the results of studies, surveys about a typical configuration of public opinion in Ukraine. It's a country which has very strong sociology and strong tradition of sociological research. It's a country also which developed this pro-EU orientation gradually. It's much stronger now than it was 5 years ago. And European Union, and I'm turning to one of the first points you made, cannot reject Ukraine. If you read the EU Charter, it is open to voluntary access to any country located in Europe which fulfills the conditions which European Union sets for membership. But the founding fathers of the European Union, people like Monnet, Schuman, had this clear vision and dream of the European Union being a voluntary union open to any country, any nation in Europe. European Union cannot say no to Ukraine, okay, without betraying the very dream, vision of Schuman and Monnet. But it has very tough conditions of entry, which includes the support of the majority of population in the referendum. And of course, very tough economic condition of membership, which Ukraine is not likely to fulfill for a long, long time. But to say that European Union does not want Ukraine is obviously incorrect. It's impossible. It's contradictory. And it's in violation of the very spirit of the EU vision. That's probably all I remember from
okay. Yes, Alan.
There was a question made. Do I need this?
Yes, you probably do.
Oh, I can yell. There was a question made about the effect of this conflict in the Ukraine on China. I understand that the East China Sea, South China Sea is being strongly affected by Chinese rock colonies, can one call them that? And I know that Vietnam is extremely concerned about this. The idea has been presented that China is emboldened by Russia's adventures in the Ukraine. What's the comment on that from anybody in the panel?
Anyone with a view on that?
Probably not disputing it. I suspect you wouldn't have grounds for disputing that possibility.
They wouldn't want to take on the 7th Fleet, though. So push against shove.
Is that likely to be invoked?
No.
So, okay, China's got an open season.
No.
Yes.
I guess I have a question for both of the Matts, so I'm sorry, Jan. My question, I guess, relates to where you feel the consequences lay for international law following this. Do you believe, I guess, really, that there is scope for a potential doctrine of responsibility to protect after what we're seeing in Ukraine at the moment? And even though the Russians clearly have, I guess, flagrantly disregarded certain norms of international law, given the language that they've cast those types of their actions in, do you think that there's still hope for the international legal dream, or?
The answer is yes.
Do you want to go first, Matt?
No.
You can start with the pessimistic view. Right. Yes is the short answer. And the reason is because it was in your question that it's obvious this is a cynical use of international norms to justify certain actions. That I have reservations about responsibility to protect. I certainly do, but I think these norms that are present allow us to make assessments about legitimate and illegitimate behaviour. And so this is a sort of a question of just because someone disobeys the rules, you don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. The international laws that have evolved probably since the middle of the 19th century have evolved off with the cooperation of states, Russia amongst them. But again, I mean, it will always get back to enforcement, you know this as well as anyone. But again, the idea is that those international laws are there as a set of behavioural patterns, of expectations, primarily. There's always going to be limitations for them in a system of sovereign states, where states can behave the way they want to without an overarching enforcement. But again, I'll sort of get back to that idea that just because they're violated doesn't mean that they're redundant and they can't be thrown out. It allows us to then look at Russia and say, this is not acceptable behaviour in a society of states. And in that respect, I think they remain valuable.
In a moment, just Matt. Oh,
yeah. Thanks.
No. I
couldn't disagree more with my learned colleague. R2P is dead and buried. It really was. It's well-meaning, but unfortunately, it's never going to be used for any other purpose than instrumental ones. Unfortunately, whether it's right intention, whether it's proportionate response, all these things are very, very noble. But how can you tell when a state is acting badly and cynically, and when a state is acting well and nobly? All its principles, unfortunately, can be used. And because of that, because there is no guarantee, I disagree with Matt that international law, although there's a problem of enforcement, you need it around so that you can say that is cynical behaviour, that is good behaviour. There is absolutely no way to tell, because you can use exactly the same evidence to fulfil the R2P criteria. I personally think that international law is going to change. International law tends to... It's not so much that the ideas change and then the world changes with it. It's the world changes and then the ideas that make it up tend to go along as well. And the reason for that is because we are getting a much more complex order, and I think Matt's absolutely right to say that we've got a more complex order emerging. How those norms and laws are interpreted is going to be very much open to question. So there's going to be more contestation around international law, what it means, more contestation around how we should understand principles like sovereignty, principles like human rights, principles like sovereign responsibilities to protect and so forth. So I think the answer is more complex than just no, but I'm happy now to leave it at no.
Okay, yes.
What I thought we might hear at some point, and I thought actually in Professor Boyce's remarks, was we'll get giving some indication it might, but it didn't seem to emerge. Say we have something like the Ukraine breaking up. There is a small bloody war. The West bit is left as a rump after the East bit is absorbed into the Russian, a new Russian empire. Right, now what happens? There are the things like the Baltic states. What would you see then might be the consequences for, as it were, call it a domino effect or whatever you want to call it?
Yes, I'm glad you asked that question.
Yes. So was I.
It's probably the crucial question because a possibility of some form of dismembering, permanent dismembering of Ukraine exists. Crimea has been annexed, and Donetsk, Kharkiv region perhaps also have the irredentist minorities which formally declare independence, but they scream Russia, Russia all the time during demonstration, indicating their willingness to be annexed also by Russia. This is a reflection of not so much of national identification and loyalties as also a complex mixture of economic and political factors. Remember, at present, the GDP in per person in Ukraine, or standard of living as measured by GDP per person in Ukraine, is only one third of that in Russia or in Poland. It's a suddenly and rapidly impoverished country, which made many Russian-speaking Ukrainians and Ukrainian-speaking Russians orient themselves towards Russia, not because they would like to belong to Russia politically, but because the standard of living which Russia offers is much higher. But that is a temporary process. Remember, in 1990, Ukraine and Poland had exactly the same level standard of living, GDP per person. At present, Poland has slightly higher than Russia. So Ukraine has enormous economic potential, but suffered from over 15 years of mismanagement and malgovernance. There was no reforms. There were attempts at reforms in 2000. Between 2000 and 2008, growth in Ukraine was considerable, over 5% of GDP per year, quite reasonable. Ukraine developed and was rebuilding not only its agriculture, which was always the big strength, but also its industry. Ukraine has very highly developed industry. Not just the quite well-known automotive industry, they have Zaz factory, not just engineering, it's the place where the largest planes and aircrafts are built, Antonov is built in Ukraine. It's not only the place where spacecrafts are built, but also the place with one of the highest IT industries. So I think the temporary downturn in Ukraine is likely to be overcome if economic reforms are conducted, similar perhaps to those which were conducted in Slovakia, Czech Republic, Poland, Lithuania, Latvia, and other countries. Ukraine has a very highly educated population, very good educational system. So the temporary Great Recession and they experienced two great recessions, very deep, very painful in Ukraine, create this temporary drop in the standard of living. First downturn was in 1991, and it lasted into 99. And second downturn of Ukrainian economy occurred as a result of the great financial crisis in 2008, and it sunk by 15% Ukrainian GDP. The former one sank GDP in Ukraine in the 1990s by between 40 and 60%. But these are temporary things. I emphasize again, Ukraine is highly developed country. So this reorientation of many Ukrainians and Russians towards Russia has strong pragmatic, or if you prefer, opportunistic background. Compare it with orientations of Russians in the Baltic republics. They strongly supported, like Russians in 1991 referendum, the independence, and they live quite happily and harmoniously in Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania, because those countries give them a standard of living which is much higher.
Well, thank you. I think Matt Kalinga would like to add to that briefly.
Your scenario that you've painted, I think, is quite realistic. But what happens next is really interesting. Now, the degree to whether there might be some sort of federation, perhaps in Ukraine, a post-Civil War federation where Kiev sort of cedes some sort of authority to those various republics. But I think you have to be wary of that idea of a domino effect. It's very important to remember the Baltic states are members of NATO. That would be the end of it. There is no more movement, especially with Russian forces, into those NATO countries. The other part of your scenario that is somewhat scary, for want of a better term, is the idea that the degree to which a civil war in Ukraine turns into a proxy war, the degree to which Russia feels a need with either armed support or boots on the ground support, and then in turn the degree to which that escalates and NATO feels an obligation in some way to send something. Now, that's a worst case scenario, but I don't think the domino that the idea that you offer is realistic. There is an end point to that, and it's certainly of those borders of those NATO countries.
Yeah, thank you. There are two more questions before we close. Two more people who wish to ask them. Philip, and then the gentleman there. Phil, Dr. Eldridge.
Yes, Matt has raised the question of federation, which is what I wanted to talk about. I mean, I suppose it's not inevitable that there has to be a war before. Everyone's invoking their origins, and I'll invoke a phrase from my native London, that federation is a sort of glimpse of the bleeding obvious. But maybe enough people just might catch that before a war. In fact, I've heard reports in the last week that there's been less rhetoric and there's been less noise on the media that people from Kiev and the East are talking a bit about it. The Russians this morning really do seem to have moved some troops a bit away from the border. Speculation that's because a lot of conscripts change after 1 year. Well, we've got the World Cup coming up as well, haven't we? I mean, maybe the Russians. What kinds of accidents can happen? We don't have to be utterly deterministic in this way, I think. As Jan says, there is a fair bit of bilingualism, or at least both languages being used. And there must be a lot of people in the East who want their Russian identity, East of Ukraine, I mean, who want their Russian identity, want to be able to watch Russian television and have more influence of Russian in schools and whatever, but would still like openness to the West. Isn't it possible that some kind of European-Russian agreement could come about, that you have trade both ways? I mean, a lot of things are possible.
One brief comment there? Can we end on an optimistic note? One more question to come over here.
If only Ukraine had qualified for the World Cup, perhaps it might be a little bit different. But no, I do think that...
Next year.
you certainly can't say that there is not a possibility of that. And I think the part that I hang on to for that is that the referenda in those areas have not been about joining Russia. They've been about some degree of autonomy from Ukraine. And I think that's the important... That offers that sort of glimmer, perhaps, of why I mentioned a federation.
Thanks, Matt. Someone over there, I think.
Yeah, I wanted to inject a note of optimism as well. I just coincidentally, it turns out I'm the last person. So,
we'll remember you then.
Thank you. A couple of things. I think often in world politics, our individual understanding and awareness lags behind the realities. The New York Times published an article last Thursday. I'll just read the headline. Workers seize city in eastern Ukraine from separatists. Thousands of steelworkers in that highly developed Ukrainian economy in the east literally took the city of Mariupol over from the separatists, and the separatists just melted away. They disappeared. I'd encourage people to read the article. I don't like the media much either, but this is an article worth reading, written by Andrew Kramer in Thursday's New York Times. So it's a cause for optimism, precisely because of the title of this evening, The Limits of Politics. A very famous Russian, who I won't mention his name, born in southern Ukraine, very famous person who was born in southern Ukraine, spoke Russian, born about 130 years ago, said that real politics begins when millions take to the streets. And those millions, and thousands have taken to the streets in Ukraine. It is, in my opinion, a cause for optimism. And it's not just in Ukraine. There was a very large protest in Moscow. And believe me, not everybody in that protest was Ukrainian. There were some very, very good Russian people in that protest. And maybe they have absorbed one of the most fundamental things which Professor Pakulski mentioned, which I think some of the people in the audience tonight did not listen to. Three things have colored Ukrainian-Russian relations for for almost 100 years. And you mentioned them, and I think they're worth repeating. And they were what? The
collectivization.
The forced collectivization, the terror imposed by Stalin, and the famine. And if Russians, ethnic Russians, don't understand what that did to the relations between Ukrainians and Russians, then they're getting a very poor education. In fact, they're getting a great Russian chauvinist education, which is the problem in this. The problem is not Ukrainian nationalism. The problem is the resurgence among some people who happen to be Russian speakers of, not all, of great Russian chauvinism. Okay.
The conduct of our discussion has just reminded me that there's a very thin line for the Institute of International Affairs between analysis and advocacy. I mean, we have a duty to highlight sensitive issues and to allow free discussion and argument within our ranks, but of course the Institute collectively doesn't have a position. I'm sure you'd agree with that. But I would like to welcome anyone who's not familiar with the Institute website, the national website, to have a look at it, because the revamped national website of the Australian Institute does have ongoing discussion of current events, and we've received quite a lot of very positive feedback from various prominent Australians about the achievement of our new website. So we've still got a long way to go, but do have a look at it if you can, if you feel inclined. It's AIIA, internationalaffairs.org.au. And that brings our meeting to a close, but before doing so, I want to thank our three speakers for ensuring that we had a very lively exchange. And there's a lot more that could be said. I know we all would agree about that, and it's a very, very critical issue, not just for the Europeans, but for those of us who are observing from afar where we are cohabiting with former nationals of both the Soviet Union, Russia now, and the Ukraine. And I hope that we'll try to remain as informed as we possibly can. I personally feel that one of the great tragedies here in this country is that we just don't have a large enough concerned population, informed and concerned. In fact, a couple of journalists in the national press just in the last week have lamented the fact that it takes a hell of a lot to stir the Australian public into any kind of agitation or even comment about international affairs. But we're all exceptions, of course, to that general observation. And so I thank you all for coming and hope that we'll see you again shortly.